This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This country has grappled with race and racism for a long time, but it's an especially problematic moment in American culture right now as painful questions about race, perception, and police action continue to erupt. In Vermont, we sometimes feel, if not immune to these problems, at least a little isolated from them. But as we've discussed on this program before, Vermont is not an island of racial harmony. Two theater companies have recently decided to tackle questions about race and racism and bring those questions to Vermont through drama, workshops, and community conversations. Today on the program, we're going to look at what they've been doing and why the directors of these groups believe theater is a good way to approach difficult topics. Vermont Stage is in the midst of its production in Burlington of The Mountaintop. It's a two-person play set on the eve of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, and it's an imagined conversation between Dr. King and a housekeeper at the Lorraine Motel. After the performances, local community members facilitate a conversation with the audience about race in Vermont and elsewhere. In Brattleboro, the Sandglass Theater Company has just finished a collaborative series of workshops and performances as part of the Race Peace Project, exploring race and identity. High schoolers, the police department, and members of the community participated in that project. Joining us today from Vermont Stage is Christina Alisea, producing artistic director of the company and director of their production of The Mountaintop. Christina, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks for having me.
And Eric Bass is co-artistic director of the Sandglass Theater Company in Putney. Eric, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Eric, tell me a little bit more about Race Peace.
Race Peace. Race Peace is an unusual project. It's the work of the artists of three theater companies in Mississippi and Louisiana. Mondo Bizarro from New Orleans and Junebug Productions from New Orleans and a group called Mugabe from Mississippi. That's men under guidance acting before early extinction, all capital letters with periods in between. Anyway, these are artists who are all creating ensemble work, devised work, collaborative work, very often on the themes of about race. Mondo Bizarro has also worked on themes of the erosion of land in Louisiana. And at some point in their work together, the artists thought that, I guess I would say from what I understand, they realized that their work about race was not about creating a theater piece. It was about using the skills that they have as theater artists to engage the community itself. And so they come into the community, they use a form of story circle, where the community, circles of people in the community tell each other stories in order to open discussions and sometimes actually create a piece of theater within the community on the subject of race.
What made you think this was a good fit for Sandglass Theater and for Vermont?
Well, Sandglass Theater has a series called Voices of Community. We've been doing this since 2005. And in this series, we bring artists from around the country whose work addresses social issues, primarily race, gender, disabilities. And some of the artists in Race Peace are people we've been working with for years. Mugabe, we brought them up in 2005 when we first opened that series. And when they told me about the Race Peace Project, I was very interested. I was very keen, I would say. And one of the things they said in a conversation was, yes, we could come up and do two performances of a show and maybe a workshop, but we don't feel that it has the same long-lasting community effect of actually coming into the community and doing a week-long workshop with members of the community that may have ripples way beyond a weekend of performances. And so that began a discussion about just how to do that here.
We're going to go a little deeper into how that worked, and we're also going to be hearing from Carlton Turner, who's one of the co-founders of one of the groups that Eric was just telling us about, Mugabe. Today we're looking at how discussions of race and racism can be facilitated through theater and drama and storytelling. Two local theater companies have been using plays and storytelling to open up conversations about what's been happening around the country and how we look at race and identity issues in Vermont. And listeners, we'd love to hear your perspective. Does art help inform your thinking on politics and culture? Do you see a lens that helps open our hearts? Call with your perspective. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Lee says anything that peacefully starts these conversations is good. And Barry writes to say films like The Defiant Ones and plays like A Raisin in the Sun probably did more to advance the discussion around race and set the stage for civil rights than all other efforts combined. Christina Alisea, the production that you've been doing with Vermont Stage of The Mountaintop, that's a relatively new play. It was written by Katori Hall in 2010, and people who read national theater reviews may remember it made quite a splash when it premiered in New York City, and not entirely positively, but certainly was a topic of much discussion. What made you want to do it and put it on in Vermont?
Well, Vermont Stage's mission is to create theater that makes our community a better place. And so that's something that I'm always looking towards for guidance as I'm picking my plays for each season. And when I came across The Mountaintop, and I'd heard, like you did, Jane, a lot about it and the controversy, and I read the play, and I was immediately drawn to it, and I felt like it was an important play that would tee up a conversation about race in our community, and I felt like it was a conversation that should be had.
And do you think that's been successful? Do you see these conversations rippling out from the performances?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, we decided to do what we're calling Talk Back Thursdays. So after every Thursday night performance of the show, we brought in panelists from the community, people who teach classes at the local universities on race and race relations, as well as people who have written books about it. To come and talk with our audience a little bit about their perspective on race. And it's been an enlightening conversation. And in fact, the last two that we've had went on for over an hour after the show. So it has been illuminating.
Fairly remarkable to see theater audiences stay for an hour after a performance.
Absolutely. The last one we had to actually end. I had to say, okay, we've been here for some time now.
We should say VPR Friday Night Jazz host Ruben Jackson is one of the facilitators of those conversations you've been having.
That's correct.
We actually have on the line with us now Jolie Garrett, who plays Martin Luther King Jr. in the Vermont Stage production of The Mountaintop. Let's play a little clip. This is not this is actually from the Vermont Stage performance. And what you're going to hear here is a scene from the play, Martin Luther King Jr., played by Jolie Garrett. And here's a scene with Mixolydia Tyler, who plays the Lorraine Motel maid, Kameh.
I am a man! I am a man! We shouted. Well, we hadn't walked but one block before we heard the sound of glass breaking. I was swept up in a tornado of arms, legs, coughing, mace. I didn't want to leave those people, Kameh. I did not want to leave them.
The white man is killing his Negro brethren, shackling his hands, keeping us from rising to the stars, bound to occupy.
You can feel the intensity there in that scene. Jolie Garrett on the line with us now. Welcome to Vermont Edition. Thanks for talking with us.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
It must be a kind of a unique experience to be embodying the spirit of a man who's known as an icon to so many people and trying to do it in a way that both humanizes him and really projects him out into the community. How do you do that, Jolie?
It certainly is a grand opportunity. And in my bio, it says I was born on the same day that Dr. Martin Luther King was laid to rest. So in a way, maybe I was meant to play this role. I consider it an honor to play this role. And I listened to many of his speeches before when I was preparing for the role, his I Have a Dream speech, his I've Been to the Mountaintop speech, to get his cadence, to get his rhythm. And then after that, of course, you have to add the action and the passion. And the emotion all comes later in the rehearsal process. But it is very moving. Playing this role, and sometimes I would be overwhelmed with emotion. And Christina would say, well, now, that's good, but we're going to have to pull it back for these purposes. And after, we can see the audience, okay, in these performances, and I can see the tears. I can see people crying because it is very emotional, and it has a profound effect on people when they hear these words, even, you know, 40-some-odd years later. And it's very powerful in the same ideas, and we're still fighting this civil rights battle here in 2015, and many of the things that Dr. King was preaching, the things that he was fighting for, we're still fighting today. And as we see these riots on our streets in Ferguson, Missouri, in Baltimore, Maryland, and we say to ourselves, you know, is this the 60s or is it 2015? And so we must continue to pass that baton and fight discrimination, inequality, segregation, and all of these things wherever we see them. And that's why this play is so important to be produced now and any other time, because until we combat, until we overcome, then we must continue this fight.
Well, given the context that you're performing this play in and those conversations that Christina was talking about with the audience, you participate in those conversations after the play, right? So what are you hearing and seeing that's been interesting to you?
Well, I'm hearing, especially here in Burlington, this sort of idea that this town is colorblind, and that to many, especially the younger generation, the millennials, that racism doesn't exist here. You know, that's somewhere else. That's somewhere down south. But of course, racism exists here. It just tends to be more understated sometimes, and because this city and the state is predominantly Caucasian, sometimes the Caucasian people in the talkbacks talk about, you know, it's our responsibility to recognize that there is still racism and realize that and find out, you know, and talk about it and not just pretend that it's not there. It is very important because racism exists everywhere. It's just more prominent in other places. But everybody talks about, you know, how can we recognize where it is, and when we do recognize it, not to be afraid to talk about it, not to get angry. Let's talk about it. There's a way to talk about racism intelligently, peacefully. But it seems that when we start to talk about racism, people get upset. When we talk about racism, when we talk about politics, and when we talk about religion, it always seems to lead to a heated argument or to a fight. So we have to learn how to talk about this thing peaceably and intelligently and say, now how can we rid ourselves of this problem? Is it possible? I think it is.
You do? You think it's possible?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it is possible if we get everybody on the same. The hard thing is getting everybody on the same page, because the problem is there are those people who believe that racism doesn't exist anymore. That's the problem. And you say,
I think also it's not talked about.
It's sort of swept under the rug.
Mm-hmm. In white households, I think it's something
exactly.
That isn't discussed unless it's sort of either something that they personally face, a circumstance on the street or an occasion that brings the conversation up. But it isn't something that people sit around the dinner table and say, I want to have an important conversation with you about race.
Exactly. Whereas in a black family, you would have that conversation, because the black parents have to tell their teenage son or daughter how to behave when they are stopped by the police, you see. What to do, what not to do, perhaps where to go, where not to go. We have these conversations. And I say, you know, racism isn't racism until it happens to you. Now, if you're a white person in Burlington, Vermont, how often are you confronted with racism? So it's just being aware that it is still here and listening. We talked about that in the talk back last week, the ability to listen. Because some people aren't listening when you're talking to them. They're thinking about what the next thing they're going to say. rather than listening to you, really listening and forming an intelligent response, because you have to process the information before you can...
Rather than an emotional one.
Exactly. Mm. We're so used to flying off the hook, to being emotional, to getting angry, you know, and we live in a society that's very instant gratification. But if we can't get the answer we want or the answer that we think we're supposed to get, we get angry. So a lot of times we aren't listening to each other, and
well,
that's what we have to start doing more of.
Yeah, and one of the ways, one of the points of going to a theater performance is certainly to sit there in the dark and listen and really engage. Jolie Garrett plays Martin Luther King Jr. in the Vermont stage production of The Mountaintop. You can see him in that production through May 10th. Jolie, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking about race today. We're talking about race and drama and how theater and the arts help facilitate these kinds of conversations. We're talking with Christina Alice of Vermont Stage and also with Eric Bass of Sandglass Theater in Putney. Eric, let me bring you back in here. Do you see that role of theater in facilitating not only that listening, but then that ability to have a conversation without fighting that Jolie Garrett was just talking about?
Definitely. I mean, I think every actor knows that the, you know, the actor's primary tool on stage is to listen. That's the main part of every actor's work and skill. It's not what you say, it's how you listen that makes you part of the piece. The work that the race piece artists have been doing here is based on it's a story circle form that I first experienced with John O'Neill, who was the one of the founders of the Southern Free Theater during the Civil Rights Movement. And it's a form in which members of a community or part of a community sit in a circle and tell each other stories around a theme. And the whole point, the first directive of this work, is that you have to listen to what everyone else is saying. You cannot be thinking about what you're going to say, because then you're not listening. It's exactly what Jolie said. And it's that act of saying, okay, I really can trust that if I listen, a genuine, an honest response, it will come. My story will be there when I need it, when I need to tell it. I don't have to sit here and rehearse it in my mind.
Christina, you see that as well? I mean, that ability for those conversations and that listening to open something up?
Absolutely. I mean, theater is an art form that I feel is its purpose serves that. You go to experience theater and you see it's holding a mirror up to yourself and to your life and to the lives of the people around you. And so experiencing theater productions is a really great way to have a conversation about all kinds of subject matter. And in fact, these conversations that we've been having have always begun with what our common ground is for this show is, okay, let's talk about the play itself that we all just experienced. And then from there, we've been building on that and talking about, well, what about the themes of race in this play across the nation, how it impacts us.
And so you think the conversations would be different if you didn't have the play to start with? You know, if you just said, we're going to have this community dialogue.
I think it could be quite different because the people that are experiencing this play, they've been impacted emotionally. They've been made to feel things that they weren't feeling prior to coming into the room. And so they're sort of have a bit of an openness entering that space than they would rather than just coming off the street and thinking about their day and thinking about the weight of you know, their lives. They've taken 2 hours to breathe into the lives of somebody else and empathize with their position. And it's with that kindness that they're there and listening. And I think that theater is one of the art forms that really can take you to that place in a way that no other art form can.
We're talking today about theater and race and how they are fitting together in Vermont in a couple of interesting ways right now, and we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about how you think storytelling and drama help open up difficult conversations about race and racism. If you've been a part of either of these productions, if you've gone to see The Mountaintop, if you were involved in the Race Peace Project in the Brattleboro area, tell us what you experienced and what these conversations then mean outside of the theater realm. How do you carry these on into your life? You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Coming up, we're going to be talking with one of the founders of the Race Peace Project. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking about race and theater. We're talking with members of two theater organizations in Vermont that have been using drama and storytelling as a way into difficult conversations about racism in our country and in Vermont. If you saw the Vermont stage production of The Mountaintop or participated in the Race Peace Story Circles in the Brattleboro area put on by the Sandglass Theater, tell us about your experience. Or maybe you're doing something else in this realm and looking at theater, drama, performance to have conversations about race and identity. How do you see drama as a lens into current events and cultural understanding? You can call us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're talking today with Christina Alisea, who directed the Vermont stage production of The Mountaintop, and Eric Bass, co-artistic director of Sandglass Theater in Putney. He helped to bring the Race Peace Project to the area. And let's turn now to Carlton Turner, artistic director and co-founder of the performing arts group Mugabe. And he's one of the developers of the Race Peace Project. He's on the line with us from Atlanta. Carlton, thanks so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Can you describe a little bit more what you were doing in Vermont with Race Peace?
Sure. Race Peace is a program that was created by a group of theater artists in Louisiana and Mississippi, Mondo Bizarro out of Louisiana and Mugabe, Men Under Guidance, Act and Before Early Extinction, based out of Raymond, Mississippi, in order to stimulate dialogue on race and racism, and in some ways begin to debunk some of the myths around race, and to also accentuate and understand the complexities of racism as a structural entity that's created by man. And we basically create space for dialogues from a personal narrative. There's a lot of race training that happens in, around the country, a lot of other organizations that provide race training and workshops. But this is particularly an opportunity for you to share your own personal narrative, which we think is really influential in understanding how people come to their own understanding about race and how it impacts their lives.
So are the discussions about other people. Are the discussions, Carlton, that you were having with students in the Brattleboro area, with the police officers in the Brattleboro PD, different from ones that you've been having with other community groups in New Orleans and elsewhere, or are the conversations in some way sort of universal?
I think that there's a lot of universal aspects. There's a lot of universal aspects to the conversation. I think anytime you're working with young people, you're working especially with high school students, middle school students, you're dealing with people who are beginning to form and understand what identity and race and ethnicity and all of those things mean to them. And so there's a lot more flexibility and leeway in that conversation. And more questions. I think when you're dealing with adults, that people have deeper and more ingrained and entrenched stories that they're operating from that informs who they think, what they think about themselves and how they see others. So I think that doesn't shift very much from community to community. And because we work on a basis of honoring the personal narrative that each individual brings into the space, that means that there's always a lot of collective wisdom that is gained by listening to the stories and engaging in a conversation about what you heard and what you feel, and not necessarily just spouting statistics or analysis that come from outside.
Christine, I understand that you've brought into these discussions after the mountaintop issues that have been coming up lately. Certainly, you had decided to stage this certainly before the riots in Baltimore, but you've been talking about police action, about police mistreatment of young Black men. How do you have those conversations?
Well, like I said, I think we start with what we all share, which is the experience of the play, and then we've been moving from there naturally as the conversation progresses to talk more deeply about the issue of race on a national scale, like the riots in Baltimore, talk a little bit about Ferguson, and just people's general experiences of that. And then we've tried to bring the conversation back home and talk about, okay, well, how has it impacted us here in Vermont? How does the issue of race affect the individual here? And that has always been interesting, getting to that place in the conversation, because there is a bit of a myth in this community that that it isn't an issue here, that it's, or rather, perhaps it's more fair to say that it's easier to talk about it from an outside perspective, that it's happening to other people and not us. Distancing yourself makes it easier rather than having to face your own inner demons. So that's been the most interesting conversation that we've had, is really bringing it home.
We got a note from Curtis Reed, who's with the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity, who says he applauds the work of Sandglass Theater to bring greater awareness to racial injustice, but more importantly, moving, nay, provoking community members beyond the conversation to action. The Race Peace Group is an excellent example of their ongoing work in this important area, and we wish more of Vermont's creative economy would follow their lead. Eric Bass, the Brattleboro Police Department has been engaging in conversations about race and about community awareness in the past. Can you talk a little bit about Race Peace and the project they did with the Brattleboro PD and how you see that coming together?
Yeah, I can. I think it's important to say that Sandglass is not solely responsible for bringing Race Peace up here. I mean, there were a number of community partnerships in place, and I simply need to acknowledge that Next Stage Arts Project in Putney through an Arts Place America grant did a lot of work. And Maria Basescu, the director of Next Stage, actually was the one among our collaborative community team who first approached the police department. I think the idea of approaching the police department obviously came out of the news, like what is this week's story about another unarmed Black man in the United States shot down by a white police officer? And what was thrilling to us was how much Chief Mike Fitzgerald at the Brattleboro Police Department welcomed this discussion, felt that it was good for his officers, felt that it was good for the police department's relationship with the community, that that this is a proactive discussion that ultimately benefits everybody. And it takes and it was revelatory, I think, to a number of us in the room, as one police officer said to me as we were wrapping up. He said the time when a police officer feels in a sense most endangered is not the moment that you run into the line of fire. It's the moment when you have to deal with decisions that have strong emotional context. And have to make those decisions quickly and have to live with those decisions as well. So I hope I haven't misrepresented that point of view, but that's what I understood. And I felt that discussion was happening in the room. And my reading of the room, we had two simultaneous story circles going on next to each other. I think I was not alone in wishing I could be in both at the same time. But my reading of the room was that there was a humanity happening within within a system that that sometimes seems to dehumanize us because of how much system is involved. And I mean, this is an ongoing discussion, obviously, between a community and its police force anyway. So I think it's a little difficult for me to express exactly what was going on.
Well, Carlton Turner, let me ask you, you were quoted in the Brattleboro Reformer as saying working with a police department is not something that the Race Peace Project had done before, actually. So what was that like for you?
Well, you know, it's had some very mixed feelings about it, both because our work has primarily been with community organizations and with affinity-based groups, mostly the affinity-based groups mostly being in the arts and philanthropy. The opportunity to work with the police was a welcome opportunity, but not one that we had before. I think as an African-American male who has had a number of interactions with law enforcement that I don't consider to be positive experiences, to be in a room where, you know, you're surrounded by law enforcement and having a conversation about race is extremely vulnerable. So you know, so for me, it was a space of being in an unfamiliar surrounding. You know, I don't tend to want to go into prisons and into police departments. That's not a place where I felt comfortable, welcome, or safe. And so this is an opportunity to shift that and humanize the conversation. And I think it's important to recognize and understand that not just the Brattleboro Police Department, but the entire state of Vermont is working across divisions, whether it be the local, the state, or county law enforcement agencies to expand their sensibilities around race and racism, discrimination and bias. And so this, it showed that there was a receptiveness on the behalf of the leadership within the Brattleboro Police Department and some knowledge of work that is already happening that made that process a lot more bearable and clear, where that doesn't exist in most communities around the country. So, you know, I think it should be happening in many communities, not just in Vermont and in Brattleboro, but there isn't the same willingness across the country as there is in Vermont to expand the humanity of its citizens and its police force.
We're talking today about racism and race and drama and how theater can be used to open up conversations about race and racism. We have some listeners who want to weigh in. Jose is calling in from Barnard. Hi, Jose. Go right ahead.
Hi. As a native, New Yorker, I grew up there, and all my friends were black. And I'm so happy because I was exposed to the kindness, the wisdom, my heroes were black, you know, and granted, I grew up without a dad, but nonetheless, exposure to each other is monumental. You know, how does a policeman feel who goes into a, you know, pretty hefty, troublesome area of town that's all black, and when you walk in there and people start looking at you, you feel weird. How do you feel when you're a black man? And the opposite is true. It's that inherent tendency to not only be ethnocentric, but to basically hold on to the same things that have been going on in countries everywhere. One race, instead of helping another or a culture, they start picking at each other. And that, to me, is so sad because, you know, I had such kindness shown to me that it really grieves me to see this because, I think it's not being exposed to each other. And I'm oversimplifying. Trust me, I'm aware of that. But, you know, how many white policemen would go to a black block party? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, Jose, I hear your point, and I take it well. Thank you for calling in. I appreciate that. I want to make sure we get to a couple more calls here. Melissa is on the line with us from Burlington. Hi, Melissa. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I saw a play at Vermont Stage Company about 6 or 7 years ago. I can't remember when. But it was about a Rwandan refugee girl, and had a long, complicated title. But anyway, the play moved me very much. It made a deep impression. And as a result, I went and signed up with the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program. And I've been tutoring a Somali refugee family in Winooski now, and that's actually where I'm going right now. I've been tutoring them for more than five years and have a very close and very, very wonderful relationship with them. It's enriched my life a lot. And so I thought it was a nice example of how theater could provoke somebody into action.
Melissa, thank you so much for calling in. Boy, that certainly does put a fine point on the power of theater. The play Melissa saw was actually called I Have Before Me a Remarkable Document Given to Me by a Young Lady from Rwanda, and it was a few years back. One more call in here. Roddy's waiting on the line from Burlington. Hi, Roddy, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I come from a totally different perspective, but I just have loved this conversation. In particular, I saw The Mountaintop actually on Sunday, and that was so moving for me because that was the anniversary of my husband's death, and he would have absolutely loved the female language for God, which was something that really bugged him, that we were in this patriarchal religion, and he wrote many, many books, theological references to how God, can just as easily be seen as female. So I want to just say theologically, I was so moved because I do believe that people who have been oppressed have access to knowledge, have access to, what's really out there, than people who are part of the status quo. And I found the language to be absolutely beautiful. I didn't want to hear anybody criticize it. I realized I was so biased.
Roddy, thank you so much for that call. What a wonderful experience. And I'm so sorry to hear about your husband, but glad you found the anniversary of his death through watching The Mountaintop as a powerful experience. Christina, just before we go from this discussion, I mean, you've just heard a couple examples there of people who have found power in theater.
I'm sitting here, Jane and I are sort of making faces at each other, thrilled to hear people call in and just talk about their experience of coming to see a Vermont stage show and how it's impacted their lives. And for me, that's just so inspiring and really does speak volumes about the impact that theater can make on our community.
Well, certainly this is a conversation ongoing in many communities, ongoing in the theater community, and ongoing on Vermont Edition. I want to thank our guests today for being on the program. Christina Alisea is producing artistic director of Vermont Stage in Burlington. The Mountaintop is on through May 10th. Eric Bass is co-artistic director of the Sandglass Theater in Putney. And Carlton Turner is artistic director and co-founder of the performing arts group Mugabe, the developers of the Race Peace Project. Thank you so much, all three of you, for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, what does the sale of Cirque du Soleil to foreign investors mean for its future in Quebec and beyond? We'll talk with a longtime Cirque watcher and critic about its position in Quebec's culture and economy. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. That music is from the Cirque du Soleil show Alegria. Picture acrobats jumping off trampolines and doing flips in the air while the live orchestra plays this song, and the crowd sits in the darkness of the stands, hands frozen in place between their popcorn bags and their mouths, watching the spectacle with rapt attention. Cirque du Soleil is a traveling human circus that got started more than 30 years ago now in Quebec. It's been headquartered in Montreal for a long time, and it's considered a cultural treasure. But just recently, it was sold to a group of investors, mostly from the U.S. and China. Here to tell us what that might mean for the future of the circus and for its position in Quebec is Pat Donnelly. She was a longtime theater critic for the Montreal Gazette. Pat, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much for having me, Jane.
What are the terms of the sale insofar as they're known?
Insofar as they're, well, the Cirque du Soleil has been sold 8% of it, as I understand, with La Liberté retaining 10% and the Caisse Populaire de Québec retaining 10%.
And Guy La Liberté was one of the founders, and he's been the
in recent years the sole owner of the Cirque du Soleil.
Mm-hmm.
And when I last spoke to him, when I last interviewed him for the Montreal Gazette in December, he made it clear that he was working on a deal. But at that time, he was only talking about maybe a 30% being sold. So he obviously changed his thinking. But he said to me at that time that he did not wish to burden his children with this huge enterprise.
Perhaps the reason behind the sale? He was tired of it and didn't want to have to put it on his family?
I think he was ready to move on. I think that would be probably the principal reason. And you know, they are going through difficult times. As he pointed out, when they began back in 1984, they were the only fish in the sea. And partly because of their success, partly because of the huge number of artists they brought to the fore, there are many, even in Quebec, many successful circuses based here. Cirque Elwaz being one. Les Sept Doigts de la Main being another. These are now internationally renowned circuses in their own right. And that's just the local competition. So there's just much more out there when they started, and they've had some setbacks. But I still think it's a very... These big companies, TPG and Fosun of China, they didn't invest to throw their money away. This is a solid company. I would invest in it if I had the money.
Yeah, I understand that 2012 was the first year that Cirque du Soleil did not turn a profit, and there has been some concern that it's perhaps expanded too big and too broad beyond its mission. In this sale, there was some concern in Quebec that the provincial government should have gotten involved in trying to prevent these foreign investors from the U.S. and China from coming in and buying the majority stake in the company. But Philippe Couillard said, we can't really do that. It's a private sale. So is there still concern now about what might happen to Cirque du Soleil?
There was some attempt to make it into a political football there. But let's look at this objectively. The Cirque du Soleil, who could buy it here other than the Caisse Populaire, which has purchased 10%, which is a big pension fund in Quebec? But to have controlling interest, you'd have to have the expertise to run the company. There is just no real viable Canadian suitor at the moment. But quite beyond that, who does the Cirque du Soleil belong to? We love it. We're proud of it. We're Quebecers. It began here. The headquarters is here, and it shall remain here because it would be really silly to move it anywhere else, given how it is situated. It is situated in North Montreal, across from the National Theatre School, and right next to a state-of-the-art circular theatre called Tohu, which is built specifically for circus performance. It's only one of two in the world. So the idea of any company moving its headquarters out of Quebec is rather, I would say, far-fetched. Secondly, who has financed the Cirque du Soleil over the years? To this day, Montreal cannot afford a permanent Cirque du Soleil show. We do not have the public. We do not have the ticket buyers here. Cirque du Soleil has always been a traveling company. A large number of its performers have always been international, from China, from Russia, from around the world. And I would say Las Vegas probably has financially contributed more to Cirque du Soleil than anywhere else in the world because there are 8 permanent shows there. So that is really where the money is pouring in and has been for many years. So to say, oh, our Cirque du Soleil, it's a bit of a false canard. It's a bit of a, they were making a political football out of something that really is a questionable thesis, you know?
So you see it remaining in Montreal for the time being. It sounds like more than 4,000 people work for Cirque du Soleil, and about 1,500 are in the Quebec area who actually work there. So it is a bit of an economic, mainstay in Montreal. In terms of Quebec's culture, do you see it as something that actually has an important role?
Well, it's very much born of Quebec culture. And again, another reason why you want to keep it here is we have some of the world's best theatrical designers here and many of them work in Quebec Theater and the Cirque du Soleil. Most of the Cirque du Soleil's top artistic people came out of the theater milieu here. This is something that is not widely recognized. But Robert Lepage, for example, he's from Quebec City and became an international phenomenon in the theater. Shakespeare productions, for example, are renowned worldwide. He has directed two shows for the Cirque du Soleil. So we have a situation where it's the artistic life of Quebec is very intimately connected. The theater life in particular is very intimately connected to the Cirque du Soleil.
Pat, we just have a couple seconds left, but you were a longtime theater critic with the Montreal Gazette, but I understand you're not exactly unbiased. You told our producer that if something happened to you and you only had 6 months more to live, you'd quit everything and go be a groupie and follow Cirque du Soleil around.
Well, the thing is, to this day, I still enjoy their shows. And having been a theater critic for 26 years, I believe, I sat through many shows that I did not enjoy. So I would say, if I'm going to be on my way out, I would like to see shows that I actually enjoy. And one of the things that you did for me today, you got me working on the Cirque du Soleil file again. I went down memory lane. It has been a long-term project of mine to write a book about the Cirque du Soleil. I recently retired, and I haven't got working on it yet. And thanks to you, this morning, I got working on the file.
Oh, fabulous. That's Pat Donnelly, former theater critic for the Montreal Gazette, telling us about the sale of Cirque du Soleil. Thanks so much, Pat.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the program, pork. More specifically, the pigs that produce the pork we eat. Vermont food writer Barry Estabrook will share what he's learned about how pigs are raised on large commercial farms and how he believes they can be raised more humanely. If you have questions about pigs and how they're raised, write to vermontedition@vpr.net and then listen to the show tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.